Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. We are online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter. We even have a YouTube channel. This program is part of our Good Lit series. It's underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Becky Worley, tech reporter for ABC News. Good morning, America. I will be your moderator for today's program. Prolific writer Tracy Kidder has been called the master of nonfiction narrative. Dozens of titles, including The Soul of the New Machine, was celebrated for its insight into the world of high-tech corporate America, earned a Pulitzer, a National Book Award. Mountains Beyond Mountains captured two global health crises, tuberculosis and AIDS, through the eyes of Paul Farmer, a single-minded physician bent on improving the health of some of the poorest people on the planet. In Tracy's latest work, A Truck Full of Money, he profiles our other guest, computer scientist Paul English, who is just by luck in San Francisco and can join us for this conversation. Paul is an unconventional entrepreneur, to say the least, co-founder of Kayak.com, nicknamed the Pied Piper of Geeks. We are thrilled they are both here at the Commonwealth Club. Welcome to San Francisco.
Great, thanks. Nice to be here.
Paul, I love this nickname, the Pied Piper of Geeks, because on the HBO parody of startup culture, the company that they're starting is called Pied Piper.
Of course, yeah.
So, you know, you're really fitting into that stereotype, but we're going to break all of this down. Really what we're going to do tonight, in some sense, is talk about the idea of a founder. The guy who has an idea, he executes it, he disrupts a traditional business to the tune of millions, sometimes billions of dollars. We want to deconstruct that story. What makes a founder tick? How do they, you, do it? And at what cost? It's really amazing that the person guiding us through this trip is someone who has a gift for making the intricacies of software engineering, computer science, business, philanthropy, not just understanding, but really riveting, Tracy. So thank you so much for both of you being with us. Let's just do a quick start on sort of the biography and the timeline here. So, Paul, where are you from? What's your family like?
So I grew up in Boston. I'm number six of seven. My brother Tim actually lives out here in Berkeley. He's with us here tonight, which is kind of exciting for me. And we grew up, I guess I would say, working class family in Boston. My dad was a pipe fitter. My mom was a social worker. And although I travel extensively and now I'm running my second travel company, I've never actually lived anywhere other than Boston. I think for a few years I was here about a week a month, I think for 3 or 4 years. Many years ago I had an e-commerce company I started in Boston that I sold to Intuit, and I served as VP technology based here. So I've lived bi-coastal a little bit, but have always really actually lived in Boston.
When you were growing up, you were wicked smart. I think is that the way we're supposed to explain this, Tracy? He was wicked smart?
Yeah.
You told the story of how Paul got interested in computers. He demonstrated, we'll call it, his first social engineering.
Yes, in the early days before there were anything like the computers we have today, he went to Boston Latin School, which is a testing school, the best high school, the oldest anyway in America, public high school. And they had a computer club. There was one central computer that was hidden away, and then these dumb terminals down in this basement room, as I understand it. Paul has reminded me of how many times I questioned him about this story again and again. But essentially what he did was figured out, he'd noticed that the instructor had a menu of options that was much larger than his, and he just felt he had to have that. So he figured out phishing. Before the term may have existed, but he didn't know about
it. PH phishing.
PH phishing, yes. And he got the control. He got the teacher's password, which gave him access to all of the menu items, which gave him control over attendance reports. Ooh. I mean, for him and his friends, which meant that for the next 6 years he played hooky a little too often, I think.
I learned my first graphics program, potentially, I'm not going to admit to any guilt, working on fake IDs, so I kind of understand this inclination to find computers for what they can do for us as tools in the real world. Paul, you alluded to the fact that you worked for a software company after college. You started a company called Boston Light. What did this company do, and then it really changed your life?
Yeah, Boston Light, I guess I would say that was my second company that I started. There's one really small company I started in high school, which I can talk to a little bit, that in some way was a little bit more meaningful. But Boston Light, I started, I believe, in 1999, maybe. And we build e-commerce software for small businesses. And the basic idea came from a friend of mine ran a bookstore in Boston, and he was very worried about Amazon when Amazon came out and thought that Amazon would be a big threat to independent bookstores. I remember at the time just feeling like, you know, we can't lose independent bookstores. I have to figure out a way to help him. So we designed some software to make it really easy for non-technical small businesses to put their products and services online. We ended up getting sold very quickly. I think we were 9 months old. We ended up selling to Intuit, because I remember back then we had half a dozen companies that were really interested in licensing our technology. But then I learned very quickly, the more time we spent with each of these, I guess there were three companies we really spent a bunch of time with, it turned out that they really had a voracious appetite for tech talent, and they wanted internet teams in their companies. And I think we made the fortuitous decision to go with Intuit, just because unlike some of the other dot-coms trying to acquire us, Intuit had things like actual revenues and profit. And after we sold to Intuit, their stock continued to grow, which is good for all of our employees.
If I could add one thing to that story, you had no revenues and no profit yourself.
No, that's not entirely true.
Well, you had the $50,000.
We had $50,000 in revenue.
And you had maxed out every credit card known to
me. I did.
And this is what I think is interesting about that story for me, because I don't know about the technical stuff. But I'm sorry, I'm being facetious. I'm sorry to do this to you. It seems embarrassing. But as I understand the story, as I think about myself in that position, I would have sold the company for whatever my credit card bills were. But Paul held out and he drove a very hard bargain indeed. In fact, he infuriated the negotiator from Intuit so much so that she hung up on him. But he sold it for $33.5 million. And then the nicest thing about that story is that he then halved his share and distributed among the other employees. And I think he did it because he has a good hat, but he also was smart. I mean, some of these were hotshot programmers, and they remember that. You know,
they remembered, and one of those coworkers told you a story that gave you the title for this book.
That's correct. Yeah, Bill O'Donnell, a great super coder, really, probably one of the best coders you've ever met.
He's the best one I've ever worked with. Yeah, by far.
Bill. And another couple of guys were taking a break from Paul, and they'd owned their own little startup, and it was kind of failing. And Paul came to see them. This was about another company, I think. And he asked them to come and work with them. And this is all according to Bill O'Donnell. And then Paul left, and the other guy said, well, we want to keep on trying. And Bill said, I'm sorry, guys, I got to go. You can have all my stock. I'm going to go and follow Paul. And they said, why? And he said, because someday this boy is going to get hit by a truck full of money, and I'm going to be standing beside him. And he was, actually. When Kayak was sold, he was standing there, and he had virtual fistfuls of stock in both hands.
That is wisdom right there.
Yeah.
Let's fast forward. Somebody approached you, Paul, about starting a travel aggregator website. How'd that go?
It worked out pretty well. We we started Kayak in January 2004, and Kayak was, so I've started, I guess I would say, five real companies, and I probably started another dozen, you know, false start companies. But Kayak was a company that I co-founded that the original idea was not mine. It was from my co-founder, Steve Hafner, who was one of the founders of Orbitz, and then one of our venture capitalists, Joel Cutler, General Catalyst. And the idea back in 2004 was there was no travel website which showed every single airline and every hotel. Instead, what we had in 2004, our sites like Expedia would only show you hotels where they got a commission. They didn't show you every hotel. And so we had a very simple idea, which was build a search engine, not a store. And once you found the hotel or flight or rent a car or anything else you wanted, we then would show you all the places you could buy it. You would click a link and you would leave Kayak, go to the other site to conduct the transaction, and we would get paid the referral fee. So it's a pretty simple idea. It was hard to build, but the idea was simple.
You know, so many people are enamored by the story of a founder, someone who's sort of geeky, has an engineering brain, comes up with an idea, and is able to execute it. It sounds so simple and it's so hard. What made you successful time and time and time again?
I would say each morning when I get up and go to work, there's three things on my mind, and I would say it's in the following order. So team first, customer second, which is funny for me to list that as number two because I've been described as kind of customer obsessed, and I spend a lot of time talking to customers, but I'd say team first, customer second, and profit third. And that's realistically how I think. My VCs might not like that I don't really think about profit too much, but I have this belief that if you spend all your energy recruiting the right people on the team and creating this magical environment for them, and then you get them aligned on, here's the type of customers we're trying to help, here's the problem we're trying to solve, the rest of the stuff just falls into place. So I guess I would say across the companies where I've been successful and the companies where I've failed, the biggest predictor of success is simply, can you attract that team and can you create a magical environment where people like love working together? And can you, I'm also a big believer in eliminating stress from the workplace. So I probably spend 5% of my time as a psychologist in each of my companies and debugging things that aren't working well. So I try to get rid of stress in the workplace.
Computer scientist Alan Cooper wrote a book about engineers who raise up and they become managers and then they become founders. And he titled the book, "The Inmates Are Running the Asylum." How come Paul isn't that guy, Tracy?
Well, my understanding, it's interesting. When he started life as a coder, I mean, his career as a coder, a programmer, a very good programmer for a rather large software firm that was doing word processing and in Boston. And he joined a hotshot bunch of guys. This was an interesting company. It had a lot of trained philosophers in its management. And this one trained philosopher, a man named David Weinberger, described Paul as he'd first seen him coming to that company. It's a brash, arrogant kind of, it's a pretty much typical young programmer. Not much in the way of social graces. And he said, somewhere along the line, some years later, I noticed, you know, he had been elevated into management and he seemed to be almost an opposite person. And he said, I went to Paul. I said, I was so astonished. I said, how'd you do it? And what he remembered Paul's telling him was, well, I realized that the brash young programmer wasn't working for me anymore, so I read books and tried to change. And Weinberger said, that's just astonishing. How could that be? Part of my explanation is that, you know, I was an English major, so, and I have a very highly developed sense of irony. But Paul was not an English major. He was an engineer, and he was not taught, as I was, to be scornful of that great self-help library of America. I mean, I think he got some stuff out of those books, and he also he has a great talent for reinvention. It's pretty interesting. I don't really understand it. I bet he doesn't either. You know.
One example of maybe something you did that you wouldn't have done when you started was the red phone.
Yeah.
What was the red phone about?
Yeah, so at Kayak, I became obsessed with customer support. For the first year, I did all the support myself. It was by email was primarily how we did support. And I could keep up with it myself the first year because we only had hundreds of thousands of customers, not yet millions of customers. I type fast. I can type it 120 words a minute, so I could keep up with most of the email. But over time, I tried to figure out how to get support being done by all the programmers, not just by me. And each year, I think over the 10 years I was at Kayak, I would come up with more and more ways to get customers in front of engineers. And I think ultimately by the time I left, I think we had 10 different techniques we used. The red phone was one of those things where it wasn't enough that we were emailing with and we had focus groups and usability testing and a whole bunch of different processes to bring an input in. But I wanted them also speaking on the phone with us. We sat in an open environment that's very typical of software companies these days. And I remember going online and trying to find the phone with a mechanical ringer that was loud. And so I found this really cool red phone that I bought on Amazon. And I put it on my desk, which was near the center of the office. And I published the phone number on the website. And so when you go to the Kayak's website and you click help, there was a bunch of ways to get help, including a phone number. And there was no PBX. It was a direct dial onto that phone. And when it rang,
it
was really loud. And the programmers didn't like it very much because I turned it up to its full volume, and they would say, that is really effing loud. And my answer back to the programmers was, you know, it's actually very simple, because unlike the phone in your pocket that you're used to, this phone has two pieces. It's an old phone. If you pick up this top piece, it stops making that loud sound. And then if you put it up to your ear, and if you say, hello, there'll be someone on the other end of that phone call who will teach you something about your product that you don't know.
You know, it's sort of awesome. Sad, though. By the time I found my way to Kayak, I got there. I didn't know that it was about to be sold. But the red phone, Paul had to finally create a team for customer service. The programmers are just, time, I guess, was just too valuable, or there were too many calls, something. But the red phone was still there, and it would ring. Bring, bring. And there were only two people in the office who would answer it anymore. One was the head of customer service, and the other was Paul. And I remember thinking, I'd see you wait, and as if you were hoping somebody would answer it. And then you'd virtually leap over desks to get to it. Sometimes.
The funny thing is, after we sold it to Priceline, I knew immediately that I wanted to leave, because I'm a better entrepreneur than worker, so I didn't really want to work for a larger company. And I think the guy that I put to take over my job at Kayak, who's still there now as CTO, he's a much better CTO than I would be for Kayak at this stage. I think he must have had a list of 10 things he wanted to change the moment I left. And one of those things was they removed the phone number from Kayak's website, which was very sad for me. I should sneak back in one night and hook that phone up and put it on his desk, put the phone number on the website. I might still have access to the server. Maybe I could log in and make that happen.
There's a history to this. Are you interested in it?
Mm.
Paul, it still is weird for me to sit here and tell stories about this guy sitting next to me. But when
it's
he,
more
when,
strange
when his father
me,
was dying,
me.
His father was descending into dementia, forgetfulness. Paul heard him on the phone talking to the likes of Comcast and Verizon, and talking to the robots as though they were human beings, and getting very frustrated. And it made Paul rather angry, and he started a blog asking people for phone numbers that would get you around these evil machines, these evil robots. And it got huge, way out of control. And so he started a little company, which one of his assistant named for him Get Human. It's still a company. It's a thriving company.
When I heard, I had no idea he'd started Get Human.
He gave it to a young friend of his, basically.
You're a hero. You are a hero to the consumers of America, because it is so maddening. I also think there's some sort of a study to be done about the tone of voice we use when we're talking to automated voices. It's zero. Agent.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
Yesterday. What is up with that?
I hope they don't record me. I was in the Army. I used every word I learned there.
How did you con him into letting you trail him around and see warts and all?
You never know how someone's going to react to it. I had written a book 35 years ago called The Soul of a New Machine. It was about a team of hardware engineers designing and debugging a new computer. And then I'd run away from that subject, really quite deliberately, because I wanted to explore the rest of the world. And I finally, some 30 years down the road, I knew Paul from Partners in Health. He was on the board, the organization that Paul Farmer and others founded. And I thought, I want to take a look at this world again. And Paul agreed very kindly to show me around. And then at a certain point, I don't remember the exact sequence of things, but at a certain point I thought that my guide should also be my subject. I mean, his career had spanned roughly from the time of the personal computer to the present with the World Wide Web and the mobile apps and so on. And also he'd had very broad experience within that world, and he seemed pretty interesting. I think in the end, by the time I was done with my research, he agreed. It took him a while to agree, and he said something very strange to me that I've never heard before. I put it at the very beginning of this book, which was, all right, you can do it. And he did not want me to write about his divorce, and I discussed that with my editor. I said, that's okay. I hope it's all right to say that. It's true. Or as Paul Farmer would say, it has the advantage of being true. Where was I? Oh, yes.
Don't portray me.
Well, but yes, he said, you have to promise not to make me look better than I am. That's very strange. No, I mean, you could take that about 20 different ways.
What does she mean by that?
So Tracy is an author that I have admired for many years. I read Soul of a New Machine back when I was in college, and I remember being shocked by that book at the time because most books about computers are very technical and heady, and Soul of a New Machine was a book that was just shockingly clear, like very simple language, complicated topics. And so I've always been a fan of his writing, and when he first asked me to show him around tech, I was really excited, and so we had a lot of discussions. I introduced a bunch of people. We came out to California a couple of times. But then when he asked to write about me, I was like, there's no way. I run companies, I don't really like being center of attention. So I thought that wouldn't be something I would want to do. And I thought in particular, if I were to agree to the project, I'd be very nervous about living under, you know, these really high expectations. Like I didn't want a book coming out and saying, gifted or special or, you know, something like really crazy, because I don't have to live up to that. So,
well, what's interesting to me in that is that a large part of trying to explain what motivates you, what drives you, what gives you special abilities is your struggle to control your bipolar disorder. And I think I had not heard the term hypomania before. Mania, yes, but hypomania, what does that mean to you, and how did it affect what you did?
Yeah, so I was first diagnosed as being bipolar when I was about 25. I had near crippling depression in my 20s and panic attacks, and was housebound for a while. I luckily, after trying many, many meds over years and in and out of therapy, I found a med that actually ended up working quite well for the depressive side of the illness, but I, to this day, struggle trying to control the ups of bipolar. Many people romanticize the ups, like it's this really great thing, and there are great things about being manic or hypomanic, but I, like on the med side, what will happen is I'll find a med that works, and then after a year, I think the way I visualize this is my brain rewires itself. It finds how to get around the meds, and then I have to try a different med or higher dosage or whatever. But I think, you know, for me, the difference between hypomania and mania, full-blown mania, which my grandmother had, my aunt had, is where you start hearing voices and you completely disconnect from reality and you develop paranoid delusions. And I've never quite had mania that severe. And the term hypomania, it's kind of like the mania right before mania. It's like the penultimate mania. So hypomania is I can go weeks at a time with very, very little sleep, you know, 2 or 3 hours a night. And I go through periods of extreme energy where I feel like I'm inventing like the next great thing. And I'm filled with what I know later is just delusions of grandeur at some point that I think I'm inventing something, you know, revolutionary. I sleep with a notepad next to my bed and actually a box of Crayola crayons. And sometimes I'll wake up. When I send emails, I email all hours, night and day. And there's a joke on my team when they get an email from me at 2 a.m., they reply and they say, is this the beginning of your day or the end of your day? Because sometimes I go to bed at 2, other times I wake up at 2. But I will, in manic phases or hypomanic phases, I often dream about invention. And I'll take out my crayons and I'll draw pictures. And then sometimes I'll get out of bed, let's say at 4. I have a really nice scanner. I'll scan that, email it out to my designers, and we start designing from things that I end up coming up with, you know, at 2 in the morning. So there's good things and bad things about hypomania. If you told me that you discovered some new pill, that I could take one pill and it'd be wiped out, so I'm not bipolar at all, I don't think I would take that pill because there are some really enjoyable parts about it, but there are downsides as well.
Almost buying a lighthouse?
Yeah, that was a little crazy.
Yeah. Tracy, you want to elaborate on that one?
Do you mind? It's in my book, I guess. Yeah, well, Paul likes parties, and he was on a run, a hypomanic run. And I'm quite sure. And this lighthouse is in the most seaward lighthouse in Boston Harbor. That is, it's really out to sea. Paul thought it'd be a great place for parties. There was an auction coming up for it. It didn't have any electricity or plumbing. And to get to it, you really had to go out in pretty calm weather, but you also had to climb a 30-foot ladder. You know, it's interesting to think of people in their party clothes climbing a 30-foot ladder with waves crashing down below them. But, you know, the next morning, he's always doing this, having little clearings in the sky. He said, what have I done? This is the stupidest thing I've ever done. It was interesting to see this. If I might, you know, hypomania, the distinction that I heard from clinicians was mania is just full-blown delusions, consumed by delusions. Hypomania is a little different. And I think in Paul, the grandiosity part is true, but you never quite know. But I began to feel like I could tell. Because Paul's normal mode is tremendous amount of energy and enthusiasm for almost everything. Really wide appreciation of the world. But somehow I could tell it was like, and I can't quite explain it except to say it was like someone plucking a guitar string and having that resonate on the soundboard of another instrument. It was the feeling of everything coming at me just a little too fast. And I have this dominant, oddly mild sounding image of it, where it's winter, we're in a restaurant, our coats are hung up nice and neatly, everything's just fine now, and I'm sitting at the table, Paul's across the table, he says something interesting to me, and I start to write, I bow my head to write. And when I look up, somehow he's dressed in his coat already, and he smiles at me and says, he's always courteous, ready to go? I'm not ready to go. I think, you know, 6 o'clock a.m. trains from South Station, it's a little early. Paul's idea of a long trip to California is 2 whole nights and a red eye home. And I think I told you that about how in earlier days he'd drive his daughter to school, jump on a plane to San Francisco, go down to Silicon Valley, work the whole day, take a red eye home and drive your daughter to school the next morning.
And she wouldn't even know I was in California.
For those of you listening on radio, you can't see Paul English, but you look boyish. There's something about you that is boyish, and you seem just full of energy. And Tracy, I was wondering if you'd read this. Joel Cutler wrote this. This is at the end of A Truck Full of Money, and I just loved this description from this Mark to hear.
Oh, okay.
Joel Cutler was with...
He was the venture capitalist who backed Kayak, and I really consider him the third co-founder of Kayak.
And I think when we're talking about what a founder is and trying to really distill down to who this person is, why are they special? Why do they have this energy? What is the cost of that? This passage spoke to me.
Paul's brilliant. This is a quote from Cutler. There's the dark side and the bright side. Paul, when he's focused and on, it's magic. He's so brilliant, has so much energy, such clear thinking. Then there's the opposite side of genius. He comes and goes. At every major milestone with Kayak, he would work maniacally and then disappear. Paul is a remarkably special person, a genius, forward-thinking, exhausting, exhausted, focused, unfocused, so complex. And I think you want me to stop there.
So complex.
So complex.
Yeah. We think we know a lot about founders. We mythologize Steve Jobs and Mark Zuckerberg and Sergey Brin, and yet we don't really know who they are as people. And I think it was so brave to open yourself up to this incredible profile. Was it been anything that has surprised you, been hard after the book has come out and this much?
Yeah, so the book came out about a week ago, and I told Tracy this morning that I didn't actually really read the book cover to cover until a week ago. I was on my way to Haiti. I do a lot of work in Haiti, and I read it on the flight down from Boston to Miami. And the thing that surprised me from really reading it cover to cover was there were a lot of stories in there that I never told Tracy, and I was kind of amazed at how much research he did. So that was fun. There were some fun stories in there that I really enjoyed that he told. I have a mentor, Tom White, who passed away a couple of years ago at age 90, and I really, really enjoyed Tracy's description of Tom White. And I guess Tracy had known Tom independent from me, so it was really fun for me to read that writing. The only surprise in the book has been how much email I get now that the book's been released. And I'm getting a lot of email from other people who suffer from bipolar illness. And tell me the life story and ask me for advice and questions. So I now find I'm spending, I don't know, at least a couple hours a day emailing with other people who are bipolar.
Is there something you could say now that we can just excerpt this and you can just send them to the WAVE file?
Yeah, I mean, my advice to other people suffering from the condition is based on how extreme it is. I mean, first of all, find a really good psychiatrist who can help you on the med side, because I think the meds can be life-changing. But I think therapy is also critically important. And having your lifeline in terms of the people who can be there for you. I remember the years that I suffered from the depressive side, I would sleep on the floor, not on the bed, and I can't completely explain this, but I couldn't be on the bed, and I would spend nights looking at the windowsills waiting to see if the sun would come up, and I had this fear, this terror, that my world would stay dark. And what I realized after years and getting help is that the light does come up, and the light isn't always the sun. The light can be a friend. And so I think for people who suffer from any kind of mental condition, a lot of it is finding who those friends are and just don't let go.
I'm going to take a quick break. This is the Commonwealth Club of California. We're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Tracy Kidder about his new book, A Truck Full of Money, Profiling Paul English, the co-founder of Kayak.com, here with us also. I'm Becky Worley of ABC News, your moderator. You can listen to the Commonwealth Club programs on the radio or in podcast, watch on our YouTube channel, and, of course, on social media. Tracy, you wanted to add something?
I wanted to say something about founders in the sort of sociological sense. I mean, first of all, I do think that we're... It's been romanticized a little too much. I mean, every young person would seem, and well, not everyone, but an awful lot of them imagine themselves starting companies, becoming founders. It's not even the money anymore. It's almost like a religion. You know, if you're unbranded, do you even exist? But, you know, it's a little like the kids spending 18 hours a day playing basketball because they think they're going to go turn pro. The odds are enormously long against successful, even good, you know, nice, modest successes. And then the gigantic ones, well, I mean, the odds are astronomical. The other thing I do, it's not necessarily the fault of these people like Gates and Zuckerberg and so on, but they are lionized in a way that would have you think that there are virtual Darwins and Newtons. You know, I mean, making huge amounts of money has always been in this country an apotheosis in itself, you know. But if you add to it the fact that we're talking about new technology and so on, it does lend itself to a kind of talk about cultural grandiosity, you know.
You've chosen to write about something that is very difficult to portray and to conceptualize for most people, and I think it's a gift. Is that by choice that you've chosen something as hard as engineering, as, you know, we're talking about founding, so, you know, these big companies?
No, it's just happenstance. I mean, it's what I jumped into. I started writing about Paul, doing research on Paul, because I thought that he'd be a good window on this world that I didn't understand. And I am interested in that world, I'm grateful for what he showed me, but as has often happened to me, I found the window more interesting than the view. And one of the things I'd say, I mean, one of the reasons that I found him worth sticking with, I mean, is that he has not bought into the cultural grandiosity of our time. Paul has a sense of when technology should and shouldn't be used. He may not always be right, but he also said to me once, and this was in the context of a homeless guy who he'd run into who was bipolar as well, something friends of his had said to him, which when he had said he felt uncomfortable about all the money he'd gotten from Kayak, and they said, oh, you shouldn't feel that way. You worked hard for your money. And Paul's response to that in his mind was, but I didn't really work all that hard. I'm just good at something that makes a lot of money. And I think there's a kind of honest humility to that that you really isn't widespread in Silicon Valley.
No, that's... Hi, prone to understatement there. Why do you think that is, Paul?
maybe there's two questions there. One, the man that we were speaking to on the streets in Boston, his name was Tim, and I remember talking to Tim and talking about him and thinking, I'm not sure I worked harder than Tim worked. We just had different jobs. As far as my discomfort with money, I think the fact that I grew up under modest circumstances meant that money people were very different than the people I was comfortable with. The guys I hang out with, there's a group of six of us, and we literally have been playing poker since we were 12 years old. We still get together and play cards together, and those are the guys I'm most comfortable with, and they are a plumber, a landscaper, a manufacturing engineer, a marketing guy, and an IT guy. And, you know, it's funny, when I take the shuttle to New York, which I do frequently, and I see people get on in business suits, I feel very uncomfortable with people with suits, and I feel like money people are very different than me. And so it's funny for me to discover, and I've had, I would say, so five real companies, four have been successful, and so I've made money a few times, and somehow I don't actually view that I have money, because I think, this is going to sound funny, but it doesn't make sense to have money, because money sitting in a bank isn't doing anything, and I think money should do things, and I'm not sure what else I need money for myself. I have a nice home, I have a few nice cars, but I don't think I need anything else with money. So money is meant to do things. And hopefully in my case, I want to die the way my mentor Tom White died, which is to die with no money. And so I have a plan just for how much I'm giving away each year now and how much I'm giving away next decade and so forth. And to me, it's actually a lot more fun giving money away than making money, because you can see the direct impact it makes if you're smart about how you give away money.
So, Tracy, there's, yeah. You have an affinity for Boston guy's named Paul who grew up Catholic and liked to give away money. Paul Farmer doesn't give away his money. No, he gets other people to give away
exactly.
Their
what
money.
Tom White, who Paul was talking about, was the person who made Partners in Health possible. I mean, in the first instance, he was a wealthy construction tycoon in Boston, but one who had never been indicted. A lovely man, really. When I first met him, he said, you know, he said kind of wistfully, he said, sometimes I think how much money I used to have before I met Paul Farmer.
So for people who haven't read Mountains Beyond Mountains, give us the thumbnail of Paul Farmer, Haiti, disease, and what he tried to do, and this is a huge, like, can you do this in 60 seconds? It's impossible,
I hope so.
But can you just make us a little picture and then tell us how Paul English ties in?
Well, Paul Farmer was he grew up in South Florida on a bus and then on a old boat that was moored in a bayou down there. He was a very bright kid. He went to Duke on a full scholarship, and he ended up at Harvard Medical School. But along the line, he got to Haiti. He met some nuns down in South Carolina and he met some Haitians who were toiling in the tobacco fields and of North Carolina. And he just felt determined to go to Haiti, where he really found his vocation. He was appalled, astonished at how poor the people were there and how terrible their lot was, and I think, you know, he went there actually thinking he was going to be an anthropologist and decided that he needed to do something in addition to anthropology, that is to say medicine. Anyway, when he got done with school at Harvard, he spent 6 years getting both his PhD in medical anthropology and his MD. And the interesting thing is he spent most of the time not at Harvard but in Haiti, and by that time he was done, he had begun to build this health system there. And he'd met Tom White, and Partners in Health, I think it was launched soon afterward. Anyway, it grew and grew. They survived through the terrible coup. They were founded during the time of Baby Doc Duvalier. They survived the junta, the 3 years of terror in Haiti. And, you know, and it's an organization I think is a model of how we might, in the rich world, help the poor world.
And he's medically tried to replicate that throughout the world in different communities.
Yeah, he's most recently in Sierra Leone and in Guinea and Liberia with Ebola, using Ebola as a tool to get those incredibly deprived countries some real medical infrastructure. And Paul, I guess I'm not quite sure where Paul came in, but he joined the board. I mean, he did some effective things there. He was on the board. He was on the part of the board that actually did things. There's another part of the board that's kind of honorary.
Of Partners in Health.
Yeah.
Now, so Paul, when you'd come into quite a bit of money, I think, was it from the sale of Kayak and you put it into a trust?
I think my first, a lot of my Kayak money is sitting in a trust. I mean, ultimately, I hope all my Kayak money will be gone. But the first time I made real money was the company Boston Light that Trace had referred to earlier. And the way I met Dr. Paul Farmer was I had made some money back in 99. I wanted to give it away. And I knew of this man, Tom White, very elusive. I think he was 80 at the time. And he had been written up as a great philanthropist in Boston. I knew his nephew. So I asked his nephew for an intro to Tom and met with him. And I had done a little bit of research before the meeting. And I had learned that he had created this organization, Partners in Health, with Dr. Paul Farmer. And I remember meeting with Tom and first just talking about his nephew, et cetera. And then I said, I want to learn more about this group you started, Partners in Health, and I understand that you guys have raised $30 million for the poor, and he was really proud of that. And then I said, but I also heard from a friend that $20 million of that came from you personally, and you probably think that makes you a good person. I think it makes you a really shitty fundraiser. And Tom and I became really good friends. Yeah.
That is awesome. That's so great. What is it, do you think? You know, I think about some of the real wealth that we have here in the Bay Area, and there's some different camps. The Zuckerbergs pledged $3 billion recently to end all disease. And at the same time, Steve Jobs was criticized for not being very philanthropic with all the money that he had made. We have two very different camps. What is it about giving away money that does it for you?
I feel like this is going to sound funny, but I feel like I don't deserve money. Like, I don't know why I would have money and this homeless guy doesn't have money. It doesn't make sense to me. It's enjoyable to give away money, and I'm inspired by people who do. One of the most inspirational things that I've seen in philanthropy in the last 10 years is when Warren Buffett said he's going to give all his money to the Gates Foundation. And that was extraordinary because it's like Buffett and Bill Gates are two of the richest guys, maybe the one and two richest guys in the country, at least at the time. And I thought they must have been competitive to see who was the richest guy. And the fact that at some point in his life, Warren Buffett's getting older and he said, okay, I think my money should be put to good use. And this guy, Bill Gates, who's sort of his nemesis in a certain way, Buffett says, probably a lot smarter than me from giving money away, so I'll let him figure it out. And I love that. I think it's a big mistake to give money to your kids. So I remember once moving the home that my children were born into. The foundation was 20 feet by 20 feet. It was a little small house. And then when my kids were age 2 and 4, we moved to a new home in the same town, working class town. It was nicer. And when the moving trucks, they're moving things into the house, my daughter Nicole and I were sitting on the front steps, and Nicole turned to me and she said, Daddy, are we rich? She was 4 years old, and I didn't know she knew what that word meant. And I said, what did you say? And she said, Daddy, are we rich? And I said, Nicole, honey, that is such an important question. I want you to remember these brick steps we're sitting on with this brick is broken. I want you to remember that tree swing we just hung up. Ask me again. And she looked at me and she said, Daddy, are we rich? I said, Nicole, honey, me and Mama rich, you and Michael have nothing. my kids have always known that their job is to give away money and then to make their own.
That's amazing. What, Tracy, can you thumbnail some of the things that Paul's doing philanthropically?
Yeah,
it seems
sure.
Like he might not list those out himself.
Yeah. I mean, just a quick preamble to that. I mean, I don't want to sound like one of the people who thinks that philanthropy is the solution to everything the way the elder George Bush suggested. I mean, I can't imagine private philanthropy ever creating Medicare or Social Security or it's being as important if private philanthropy had done it. But that said, you know, in the absence of other sources of funding, it's terribly important. What Paul has done doing in Haiti is a project called Summits. I mean, education, and it's basically taking over 41 schools that Partners in Health started and that are in bad need of good instruction. And I think that the main effort right now is to improve teacher training there. It's in the one of the more impoverished parts of the country. I think Paul's view, I share it actually, is that if there's a way out for Haiti, it's got to be through education. Education is a necessary part of that, along with public health and medicine. Then the other project, one of the things he told me once, and I think it's pretty wise, was he liked to invest in people. That is, people who knew how to do something better than he did. There's a magical man in Boston, a magical doctor who has spent his life. I mean, he's an attending physician at the Mass General Hospital, but he has spent his life working with the homeless. And instead of making himself rich or anything else, he's famous in Boston and very humble. And I met him through Paul. Paul met him through a friend who, and that was where he met the homeless guy out on the
street. My mother's in O'Connell, so I know.
Oh, you know this man?
No, but I know the name. We're
Jim
all
O'Connell,
good
people. Yeah, he's a lovely guy, and Paul's invested pretty heavily in him just recently, since I finished my book. Isn't that right? I mean, pretty heavily.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy, Jim O'Connell. I've done night tours with him in Boston, where we go out in a van and try to find areas where homeless people could congregate. And his two objectives that Jim has when he goes out at night. One is to see if there are any immediate needs he can attend to. And the second one is just checking in on people on their overall health care, their overall potentially family situation, a living situation. And it's been fascinating for me to look at, in the nonprofit world, we are faced often with, do you do short-term investments or long-term investments? And I think the answer is you have to do both. The next question is, what percentage, like for the money I invest in homelessness in Boston, alleviating suffering there, what percent of my money should go towards things which help people like literally tonight, and what percent should go to root causes and addiction programs? And I'm not sure yet exactly what the right answer is about how to do short-term versus long-term, but Jim is a guide to me, and I'm learning more and more about it. So that's the two main areas where I'm spending in nonprofit. There's probably a couple dozen nonprofits that I'm involved in to some degree or another, but the two largest ones are the ones that Tracy mentioned. So Summits, it's a network. We have 10,000 students in the Santa Plateau in Haiti, and then doing a number of initiatives around homelessness in Boston.
I felt like I really learned something in that line that, you know, it's a very homelessness is a very complicated problem, but at least tonight we can give you clean socks.
Right.
That said a lot to me in that one sentence. I want to get to some of the questions from our audience. Really good questions here. For Paul, this one, what's the biggest risk you ever took?
Wow, so many. I'm thinking about my life in crime.
Maybe talking to Tracy Kidder.
that was a big risk. You know, Tracy is a very charming guy, and he gets you to be pretty open pretty quickly. So I think that was a little bit of a risk, but I'm pretty happy with it. Biggest risk, I definitely blew through savings like a lot of entrepreneurs. I spent my 401k at one point and maxed out credit cards, but that's not that interesting because I knew that even if I lost all my money, I'm a good coder, and I figured worst case scenario, I can get a coding job, make $100 an hour, and just make money again. I'm not sure what big risk is. I did a lot of risky things in my teenage years that it's kind of amazing I'm alive with the amount of drunk driving I used to do and some other bad things, but I'm not sure.
This is sort of a follow-up. What's your best advice for anyone trying to create a successful startup?
That's easy. It's work really, really hard to find a good co-founder and work really hard to figure out who those first five employees are going to be. And if you put in the extra effort and recruit constantly, just constantly, 24/7, trying to turn over every rock to find more people, if you can form that first five-person team that is not only extremely good at their task, but the other 50%, they just have really great, great, great team skills that you get enormous payback because the first five hires the next 20, and the first 20 hires the next 100, and on and on and on. And I think the biggest thing an entrepreneur needs to do is figure out who's that first team of five and just be, just have an extremely high bar on those two criteria, sort of the GSD, get stuff done score, and then the making sure people are just really phenomenal teammates.
This next question is sort of an amalgamation of a couple of questions that have come in for Tracy. Tracy, list off the subjects of, just pick five of your books, the subject matter.
Well, I wrote a book about those computer engineers. I wrote a book about an elementary school teacher. I wrote a book about the building of a house. Somebody asked me when I was working on that, you mean you're going to write a whole book about the building of a house? Actually, I wrote a book about it, basically about a cop in a town, and I wrote a book about some old guys in a nursing home who were doing something more interesting than playing bingo, which was making friends. I wrote a book about my own year in Vietnam as a soldier called My Detachment. And I wrote Mountains Beyond Mountains. I wrote a book about this fellow, Deo Gracias Nizonkiza, who was a Burundian, now American, but he was a young medical student who escaped from civil war and genocide and came to the United States and has gone back to Burundi and has created really quite a marvelous health system. I met him through Paul Farmer, too, actually. So those are
the question, I think, that comes from listening to those subject matter is, how do you decide?
I don't have an algorithm for that. I wish I did. It means your life is pretty good if that's the biggest problem you have. But it is the biggest problem that I usually have as a writer. It's trying to figure out what to do next. And I mean, I remember once being so afraid of wasting a year on the wrong project that I actually wasted two. But I just have to feel my way into it. And often I have to go out and spend some time with someone. And I've been with some admirable people and interesting people, but not. It just didn't. I couldn't see it. You know, I couldn't see my way.
Yeah. What have you chosen not to write about?
Well, at one point I was going to write about wilderness, and I did spend some time out in Montana and the Bob Marshall Wilderness. And then head editor of the Atlantic Monthly said to me, "Is this going to just be more beautiful writing about beautiful places?" And I thought, "Yeah, you know, really, I'd kind of like to write about people, and there's mostly bears out there, so do that." I wouldn't want to hurt those people's feelings. I spent some time with an interesting congressman, and I was going to ask him if I could write about him. He really fascinated me, but then he decided to run for Senate, and he won, even worse. But I put that aside. If, however, this election goes really badly, I might turn back to that subject. Because the best thing about Trump, from the point of view of a writer or a reporter, is he's got really thin skin. Sorry, I was way off.
You're allowed. You're allowed. You know, when you talk about writing about these subjects, so diverse as they are, but you obviously immerse yourself so much in it. And, you know, Paul, when Tracy writes about software, I mean, is there anything more boring to describe than software? And yet, I felt like you really made it come alive. You know, I think there's very little writing. I mean, I can think of Douglas Coupland writing Microsurfs. I think, you know, maybe Aaron Sorkin trying to bring The Social Network to life. And now we've got Silicon Valley, Mike Judge's parody of the startup culture. But I haven't seen many things that brought it to life as much. You know, one example on a page, you actually wrote assembly language code for what would have been Hello World, and I'll show this to the audience. It's about two pages of tabs or spaces, depending on if you're a tabs or spaces person.
I'm impressed.
If you're, you know, you've got all this little dot, R-O-D-A-T-A-A, dot L-C, but you included it.
Oh, yes, but it was written for me by a friend of Paul's.
Right, but then you compared it to how, if it was written in BASIC, that it would be basically 15...
That's that.
Print.
Versus that. Print, and I think right there you know what the high level is.
That brings it to life. I mean, it's really hard. Paul, did you find that this was authentic to the craft that you've sort of devoted your life?
Yeah, I had mentioned that I first really read the book for the first time cover to cover about a week ago on a flight to Haiti, but Tracy did give me a copy of the book a few months ago, and he said, you have 24 hours to read it. And he basically said, I'm not going to rewrite anything, but if you find some egregious error, I might consider, you know, striking it. And then I skimmed the book really quickly, and I just went on the technical parts of the book looking for technical errors. I think I found a couple of really minor things.
You QC'd his book.
What's that?
You QC'd his book.
Yeah, I did. I did. I QC'd the technical parts of the book.
That's awesome.
I don't always do this, but, you know, I try to do it right near publication before it's almost too late. And it's done as a courtesy. And I wouldn't do it if I hadn't trusted him. But, I mean, I do believe that, you know, it has to be independent. I can't allow the person I'm writing about to say what I can say. I did not. I did write an enormous amount about writing software. I had thought, there's a wonderful story. One of my favorite stories in this book is about Paul's coding his way out of depression, out of a terrible depression. We created a website back when this was not trivial to do, to play a game of Chinese chess, a game called Shangxi, probably the most popular board game in the world. And he did it with the help of a guy who I became very close to, a guy named Carl Berry, wonderful programmer himself. And I thought, and I made poor Paul sit almost a whole day to go through some of the code that he wrote for this thing. I think it was the client code. And, you know, and we went through it line by line by line, and there was some wonderful stuff in there. Once you get your head inside software, it was pretty interesting. I mean, for instance, there was this incredibly complicated thing that he had done to scrunch everything down so there was only just a little bit of code to do a lot. And it wasn't at all necessary anymore, but it was something he'd learned to do when he was a kid, when he only had, you know, a tiny little memory to rely on to make his silly, not silly, his wonderful little games. Cupid, he had a game that he created, you know, with 5K of memory or something like that, or less, actually. And here it wasn't an issue anymore, but he still was using these tricks. And I just thought all of that stuff was so interesting, and I wrote it. I have I've had the same editor, real, you know, line by line editor for years and years, 40 years. And he, when I presented this to him, it was a pretty late draft. He said, "Kidder, this is exhausting. I just can't stand."
Well, you've perfectly conveyed coding. That's exactly what it feels like to most humans.
I think there must be a way to do it that's fascinating, because it is fascinating. It's just you. Well, it's complicated.
This is another question from the audience. This one's for Paul. What's your next great idea? What are you working on now?
So I spent the last 10 years of my working life trying to revolutionize online travel, where most investment in travel tech has been. So sites like Kayak, Expedia, Priceline, on and on and on. And I've now decided to spend the next 10 years of my working life. I probably spend 50% of my time doing for-profit and 50% doing non-profit. But for the for-profit time of my workday, I'm now focusing on trying to make some big changes to what is known as offline travel, travel assisted by a human. So we have, my new company is called Lola, and we have a team of 20 travel agents in Boston. We have an iPhone app and soon Android, and it's a messaging app, and you simply can message with a travel agent 24/7. And we also have an AI that we're building that does a couple of key functions. And one of the debates, raging debates we're having internally right now, is does Lola think of itself as a human-led AI company, or do we think of ourselves as an AI company backed by humans? And the differences are quite significant, and we have raging debates about which direction to head. But right now, I just have this very strong belief that humans do provide significant value add when you're planning complicated travel. And I know the answer somewhere is something with how humans and computers come together. And we're trying to be on the forefront. There are a lot of people working on this problem in many industries, And we're trying to be the guys in the travel industry that thinks about, if you threw out all the software that travel agents use and rewrote it from scratch to try to provide a much better solution for end users, for travelers who sometimes want to talk on the phone, sometimes they want to do email, sometimes they want to do messaging, what's that world going to look like? And that's what we're trying to figure out. And we're early. We're just past our one-year anniversary. Just 50 people, all based in Boston.
What do you think of startup culture right now? It seems at times that we're trying to disrupt and disintermediate things that maybe don't need it. I'm getting pitches daily for dry cleaning disruption, and I could go on endlessly. Have we reached sort of a nadir of the real innovation, and now we're just picking off the fine points?
Well, I have two thoughts about that. One is, I was talking with someone earlier today about this phrase 1% that a lot of times we use to make fun of ourselves when we're designing things for the 1%, such as, I get annoyed when I call an Uber and I punch in my address, and then a minute later the driver calls me and says, where can I pick you up? And I'm like, I just typed in the address. But this is what I would call a first world problem or 1% problem. Someone needs to come up with a term like that that is software engineers designing software just for software engineers, because I think a lot of the stuff that we're designing and writing plans for is completely ludicrous. It doesn't really relate to the main population. To me, entrepreneurship, the most important thing to me, the team is the most important thing. The second most important thing by far is not the technology you're building, it's what's the problem you're focused on. And is the problem big enough? Is it a big, meaty problem that lots and lots of people have? I tend to like mass market. I like B2C rather than B2B. And so I like focusing on problems that literally millions and millions of people have. And if you focus on the right problem and you have the right team, eventually you're going to figure out the right solution, even if the first one isn't it. But my advice to entrepreneurs is pick a really big problem that a lot of people have, not just a problem that software engineers have, and just don't let go of it.
There's so much obsession now with STEM curriculum and teaching engineering, math, coding in schools, and yet there's a certain personality type that really goes to this type of thinking. How do you think those two ideas will mesh? And this is, this is something that you talked about quite a bit in the book, Tracy, about the 2% of people who are natural coders or drawn to it.
That comes from, for me, it comes from Donald Knuth, who says it comes from someone else, although he says he's observed that. Donald Knuth, in case you haven't heard, this wonderful man is perhaps a progenitor of computer science. He probably would object to that. But he has written extensively and really organized it as a discipline, a scientific discipline. But he's also written stuff that is completely comprehensible to the likes of me. It's quite wonderful, philosophical and fascinating. And he does have a hypothesis. The way he puts it is he says that he figures that 2% of the people who built the pyramids would have been great computer programmers if there had been computers back then. So it's a sort of a human talent that was awaiting its instrument. But it's a fairly rarefied talent. And obviously these programs to try to learn, teach all kids how to program are not aimed just at the 2%. But the 2% are the ones who make the magic black boxes that people are now assembling. That's what he put it to me when I had the great privilege of interviewing him. Paul's company that he started, which I think is kind of folded up, which was an incubator, had solicited some applications. And some of them were really, well, by and large, these public applications, these ideas were not big. A better kind of automated pet door for Helms with small animals, or yet another app to make parking in cities more congenial. The most powerful one to me was, I hope I'm not going on too long, but was a young man who said, the problem I'm trying to solve is the inability of people to really connect with each other in the modern age. And because we're so often looking at screens and communicating over screens, he said, but there's something to be said for face-to-face human contact. I thought this was so poignant. Here's the thing. Yes. I thought this is a great statement about the anomie of perhaps of a generation that, who text each other while they're in the same rooms. But then he went on to explain that he was developing an app to solve this problem.
What do you think, Paul? Is innovation in technology behind us or in front of us?
I think innovation's accelerating. I mean, probably every computer scientist has been saying that for 50 years, but I'm excited about machine learning. I think the rate of advancement in machine learning is getting better, better techniques, better platforms every year. So I think AI is advancing at a rapid pace. I'm excited about the whole service on demand. It's been written quite extensively about, but I think it's written about so much because it can be an equalizer where anyone can set up shop and become a contractor to do all kinds of services for people, where your phone, largely, I look at phones as doing two things right now. One is this little piece of glass we all carry around in our pocket connects you to humans that you can message with. People now spend more minutes a day using messaging apps on their phone than they spend using all other apps combined. So it's a messaging device, and it's also a device to get people to do things for you. So get me a car, bring me groceries, bring me liquor, pick up my dry cleaning, on and on and on, plan my travel. And I do think that the idea of virtual workforce where anyone can be the other side of that piece of glass to do anything you need is pretty exciting to me.
Well, Tracy, those are a couple subjects for your next books. Maybe the singularity is where we'll end.
I think I'm done with this technology. I mean, don't forget there are many others, and I don't see how technology can actually stop, given that we're human.
Our thanks to Tracy Kidder for visiting us and talking about his new book, A Truck Full of Money, profiling our other guest, entrepreneur, founder, Paul English, co-founder of Kayak.com, and a most unconventional entrepreneur and philanthropist. Really great to hear your stories. I'm Becky Worley, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.